Dr. Emily Kostelnik, welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't you start off by telling us about what you do professionally?
Sure. So I'm a clinical health psychologist, which means that I am a clinical psychologist with a specialization in health psychology, which is kind of like the interplay between medical illness and mental health, kind of broadly. And with my own personal medical history, I kind of became more specialized within the health realm in chronic dizziness and vestibular disorders. I don't know how much you want me to go into my own experience. It's like all over the internet, so I'm really an open book about it. But I was really inspired just based on kind of living through it, having to navigate the medical system, all the challenges that come with that, how debilitating it can be to live with chronic dizziness, that I thought there's like such a gap in this area for people with mental health, behavioral health background, that that's really what inspired me to pursue this specialization.
So I think maybe a little bit of background in terms of what your experience has been that's informed your career decision-making and also informs your ability to connect with your patients.
Yeah, sure. So in 2017, I was a postdoctoral fellow. So I had just graduated from my program and I felt kind of like a fullness in my ear all the time. Didn't really think that much of it. I won't belabor the point, but anyway, I eventually was diagnosed with superior canal dehiscence syndrome and developed really debilitating auditory and vestibular symptoms. So for those that aren't familiar with that, it's pretty rare. It's a mechanical defect. So it's a bony defect in the inner ear that allows sound and pressure to abnormally be transmitted into the inner ear. And so I pursued surgery to plug the hole. There's different kind of surgical approaches, but my first surgery was a craniotomy, which eventually was not successful. So they essentially didn't plug it enough. And then about a year later, I went back for a revision surgery through the transmastoid approach, which is kind of the other approach. And then throughout pregnancy, postpartum, I developed vestibular migraine and triple PD. I've had BPPV episodes. So I feel like I've experienced like the full gamut of vestibular flavor of symptoms. And I think that just really helps me connect because I've been there. Like I get it. I get the nervous system activation. I get the mindset piece. I get how big of a player that is in all of this. And that tends to be the biggest missing piece for people, like with recovery and what can prevent people from recovering and what can maintain symptoms. So that's kind of like the short answer to that question.
How long was it between the time that the onset of symptoms started until you sought treatment, medical help for it?
So I think that the earfulness probably started the year prior. So I'll say like 2016. And I think I attributed it to like allergies. Like I just thought it was like a benign thing. But there was sort of like a point when everything changed, which my ear went from feeling full all the time to one day I was doing yoga arm balances. So like I had a lot of intracranial pressure and I stood up from that and like I was never the same. So like I felt kind of like a floating sensation. I remember things sounded really distorted in my left ear. Some like sound induced vertigo. I could hear my voice really loudly in that ear. Luckily I was seeing an ENT who had trained at Johns Hopkins and like was kind of there when this kind of all came to be. And so he's like, oh, I know who to send you to. And so he sent me to one surgeon locally to where I was doing my postdoc in Boston. So that's where I had my first surgery. And then I had my revision surgery at Johns Hopkins. So
from your symptom onset to a accurate identification of what it was that you were experiencing, sounds like it was pretty efficient as far as dizziness can go.
Yeah.
But
I was
also
really lucky. I was really lucky in that regard. I remember going to the ENT that I was seeing who had been just treating me pretty conservatively with like nasal sprays. Mm-hmm. He did he did a scope to kind of like see like what my eustachian tubes look like. And I have some level of eustachian tube dysfunction too, as many of us do. But I would say from the time that I said, these are my new symptoms. And he's like, well, there's this thing called Tapiric canal dehiscence. I don't think you have it. And I immediately went home and Googled it. And I was like, I definitely have that.
It's one of those rare times like Dr. Google is right.
Yeah. And so I would say between him saying that to when I actually met with the surgeon was very fast. Like I would say it was within 2 weeks. So I was definitely the anomaly.
That's excellent. And you had mentioned before the idea of mindset for patients that are experiencing dizziness. I'm very curious how you delve into that with your patients and how you help them understand what it is that they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like this quote that I see all over educational materials that people with vestibular disorders are 3 times more likely than like the general population to have anxiety, depression, panic symptoms. And that's all true. I find though that those terms are less descriptive of what's actually going on for the patient, if that makes sense. Like the terms anxiety and depression, they're really broad. They're very stigmatized and it doesn't really get to the core of like, why is this happening? What's happening? It doesn't necessarily help them. Maybe it can help them a little bit, but get them to where they want to be, if that makes sense. So I think of it more from a nervous system perspective. So if we think of our autonomic nervous system with sympathetic being the fight or flight, parasympathetic being rest and digest, and the huge overlap between like the vestibular system activating the sympathetic nervous system while the vestibular system is working or dysfunctioning, and how we can get stuck in sort of limbic dysfunction, so the emotion center as well. And so we end up with this really vicious cycle of associating the terror we have when we first experience vestibular symptoms that are activated by the vestibular system itself. So every time we experience those symptoms, it's become paired together. So it's kind of like neuroplasticity gone bad or negative plasticity. So it's when neuroplasticity or your brain rewiring itself based on your experiences and your beliefs and all of these things, when your brain can actually rewire in a maladaptive way, if that makes sense. And so it's about parsing those two things away from each other. So how can we experience vestibular symptoms without always having this level of panic or the same rumination, the same avoidance, the same behavioral, like maladaptive behavioral strategies? That's a big part of it. So what that tends to look like in practice, I know cognitive behavioral therapy is like the big thing that everyone talks about. It's what has the most research. I use components of that. I actually would say it's not the most helpful or effective strategy that I have found. I prefer a more mindfulness-based approach. So CBT is a second wave behavior therapy. It's about changing your thoughts, essentially. I prefer third wave behavior therapies, which are more mindfulness-based and more around changing your relationship with your thoughts. So with CBT, you can get into this push-pull a lot. So one thing I see come up over and over again with patients is one of the things that can help you with changing these thoughts are asking, like, what's the evidence? So if someone comes and they're like, I don't want to get in my car, I'm terrified I'm going to have a vertigo attack. If I'm the therapist, I say, okay, what is the evidence for that? They're going to be like, well, I had a vertigo attack in the car yesterday. And so it's like, then it becomes very challenging to work with that because they have very tangible evidence. Whereas if we're working with someone with social anxiety, for example, and they say, I'm worried everyone's looking at me. What's the evidence you have? Like that, it's not apples to apples, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I find using a more of an approach around, psychological flexibility, stopping to avoid things, coming up with emergency plans, creating some space from those thoughts and realizing that not all of our thoughts are true. Are these thoughts helpful? Are they in my best interest? How do I live in service of my values? How do I create a meaningful life? All of that is sort of where I live. I don't believe like that the nervous system activation or the anxiety is like a separate thing than the vestibular disorder. I think it's really all interconnected. And if we can calm that mindset, if we can calm that nervous system, it actually impacts the vestibular system and the inflammatory process and those epigenetics that are turned on and off all the time in a positive way.
So as I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking of a Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. You have your sympathetic nervous system, your parasympathetic mm-hmm. nervous system, your limbic system. Mm-hmm. And above all of that is vestibular system, dizziness, vertigo, all of those potential descriptors of the experience. Mm-hmm. And then I'm picturing you working with mindset to adjust that Venn diagram mm-hmm. so it's less having less of a negative impact on the individual that's experiencing that sensation of motion, that sensation of dizziness, whatever the specific experience is, these tools that you're assisting them to create or come up with, having a plan, is allowing them to kind of weather that storm. Am I thinking about that correctly?
Mm-hmm, I think so. I think I'd have to think more about exactly what the Venn diagram would look like. But yes, in terms of how all of those things are related, I think it's really about befriending the symptoms almost, like mm-hmm. starting to look at the symptoms in a different way. So I use things like somatic tracking, some things from like pain reprocessing therapy. It's a lot about coming more into your body and less into the cognitive piece, which I know might sound counterintuitive with like cognitive behavioral therapy, but what I find in my practice is that I tend to see people who are very high achieving, very cerebral, very highly intelligent, caretaking. Like there's sort of a certain personality type that I fit that to a T also. And I find people come to me and they're trying to cognitively problem solve their way out of symptoms. And that just doesn't work well. You know, like they've used that strategy throughout their life to maybe get to their advanced degree or maybe to problem solve whatever family situation is going on. But when it comes to internal sensations, we can't cognitively problem solve those. And so a lot of times people are very almost divorced from their bodies. So like they're very uncomfortable in their bodies. If I ask them to put their attention on their chest or put their attention on the sensations that they're feeling, they want to run away from it. So a lot of it is turning inward and realizing how can I coexist with this and do the things that are important to me and create this meaningful life? And symptoms can tend to like be put more in the background and can fade away more, if that makes sense. I know it sounds abstract, but in mm-hmm. practice, it does work.
So in our discussion of vestibular symptoms with our patients, we'll oftentimes talk about the different potential origins of them. That are they centrally or originating? Are they peripherally originating from the ear, from the brain? Are they related to the vascular system, high blood pressure, low blood pressure, high blood sugar, low blood sugar? And we talk about hydration, and we may talk about anxiety as well. But the more I talk about vestibular dysfunction, I actually wonder if anxiety isn't its own bucket, but there are these symptoms that are present, and because they're not understood, it's leading to these feelings of anxiety. And we need to manage both the psychological component and then the physical component of what could be going on. And so often the psychological component is misunderstood by the medical community, that mm-hmm. there'll be the default to say, oh, this is in your head. Oh, the person's crazy. Oh, the person's this, the person's that. And it's no, there's something we haven't identified that's then leading to these feelings for the individual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think the reason why the term anxiety, I feel like anxiety equals psychopathology, if you want to put it that. Like anxiety is not normal. Anxiety means you have a problem. But my argument is if you wake up and the room is spinning out of control, you're going to have anxiety.
Anxiety is a good response to that.
Yeah. Right. Like you're going to have like a serious autonomic nervous system reaction to that because we perceive that as danger. And I would say that that would be like a normal reaction. Mm-hmm. And so I think like even just the educational piece of that is a powerful intervention for patients because they've been so dismissed, or even like I've worked with a lot of physicians who don't want to work with dizzy patients, which I already hate that term to begin with. So there's already this stigma about like what people who come with vestibular disorders or with dizziness, there's already a stigma around that. And I think that impacts the way that the providers are kind of interacting with people in this situation. And so I think so many people are left feeling like they've been gaslit, misunderstood, like they're a problem, there's something wrong with that. And so I think even just validating like, hey, it's normal for your body to perceive danger when you have these out of control symptoms, that in and of itself can be a powerful intervention. And like, how do we work with that to try to unpair that from the symptoms themselves?
I find this to be unique when the provider experiences very similar symptoms as the patient, because you can understand what they're going through and feeling on a much more personal level. Like with our cochlear implant recipients, if they're having trouble adjusting to it, sometimes we refer them to a mental health professional that actually wears a cochlear implant because they can understand it in ways where we can't necessarily. So I would think that ability to resonate with the patient puts them more at ease and also puts their trust in you.
It definitely does. And I think kind of like historically in the mental health field, we are taught to be like a blank slate and to not, you know, tell that much about ourselves. And that's totally not the way that I practice. I think a lot of the things that I do are pretty unconventional, but I think a lot of the magic of patients working with me are that like I relate and I can tell them about my personal experience and they feel very validated knowing I've been there, but also I'm really happy with where I am now. And it's possible to have 4 vestibular diagnoses and like still not live with dizziness on an everyday basis. And so I think that is extremely helpful for people. And yes, it's the same. It's similar to anything. Like certain people of certain cultures want to work with a therapist of their cultural background because they just feel like they get it more and they don't have to start from the beginning and like explain their whole story, which they've done already, you know, 15 times at every other doctor. So I think there's a level of comfort in that.
Do most of your patients come in with symptoms or with actual vestibular diagnoses?
I'd say most of them come in with diagnoses. However, I have seen people who I believe have been misdiagnosed. And in that case, I will send them to if they're like trusted physicians around that I've worked with, I will send them and kind of be like, hey, I would, you know, recommend further testing. A really common one is people will come in and say, I have triple PD. That's all that I have. And as we're talking, I'm like, I wonder if you have vestibular migraine. So that's a really common one because there are many more migraine treatments than there are for triple PD. So I would say that's probably the most common situation that I see.
Do you think the patient population that you work with necessitates working outside of the box, that not being that blank slate, that here are these people who so often get shuffled around the medical system, the healthcare system, that in order to properly treat those people, they need to be related with in a way that other providers are either unwilling or unable to do. So maybe if somebody's looking into getting into psychology with a focus on patients with vestibular dysfunction, this is the way to do it as opposed to an outside of the box way to do it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's challenging because I've thought about like bringing on other psychologists or, you know, building my practice in that way. And I've talked to even my own surgeon and stuff about like how to build awareness and how do we train these people. And it's so hard to train people on my lived experience. Yep. And that's, it's like, I don't want to take my skills with me and not, you know, share them with people. But at the same time, like I can't train, you know, teach every single thing that I've been through. So I think that there's a place to start with like the out of the box. This requires a multidisciplinary approach. I mean, if you look at the literature, they would say like the gold standard for chronic dizziness is like medication. So probably like an SSRI, SNRI, depending on the diagnosis, CBT and BRT. I would say I cannot think of maybe like 2 people in my private practice who came to me really early in the process, but everyone else in my practice has tried all of these things and they're still in a ditch and they're not happy with where they are. And so I think that I probably work with an especially complex population. So I don't want to say that that's like the vestibular disorders population at large, because I'm sure those things are enough for some people. But for the people that I work, we need to dig way deeper. So we're talking about specific dietary changes. We're looking at inflammatory markers. We're talking about working with functional medicine. We're talking about vision therapy sometimes. Do you have sleep apnea? Do you have a history of trauma? Like all these other ancillary things that really need to be addressed, that those three things, like the meds, CBT, and VRT, like it just doesn't cut it for a big piece of the population.
We actually spoke recently with Dr. Madison Oak. She's the one who introduced us to you and your content. And she could not stress enough the importance of dietary changes and lifestyle changes. What would you say are the key lifestyle components to keep in mind for people who are struggling with vestibular issues?
A good question. Sleep is probably like at the very top. Stress management, movement. The dietary piece is really tough because it's such a powerful intervention, but I've also seen it go wrong so many times. So there are different like migraine diets or different like specific elimination diets that people try, and they can be very, very helpful. However, the kind of pitfall that I've seen happen is a doctor will be like, hey, try this diet. They never follow up with it, about it again. People develop fear around food. They develop like their microbiome diversity changes. So they get more food sensitivities, then they end up with nutrient deficiencies, and they end up in this vicious cycle where then if they try to reintroduce any foods, they react to everything. And I say this not to scare people, like it can be undone, but it's harder to undo than if you had done the elimination diet for like 6 to 8 weeks. So the dietary thing that I would say I've seen be most helpful far and away is blood sugar regulation. So thinking about like how the cortisol curve works. So like cortisol is highest in the morning, melatonin, kind of the inverse relationship with cortisol and melatonin. So cautious of what you're eating in the morning, because your cortisol, the way it works is it releases glucose into the blood. So if you're having a super high carb breakfast, you're getting a double dose of blood glucose. And so a lot of people will crash after that and say they feel terrible. Eating regularly, hydration, electrolytes. But in terms of the diet piece, I have seen low carb be really helpful. I've seen low histamine be really helpful. Those are kind of like the two that I would say. Environmental toxins is a really big one. So looking at what products are you using? Are they endocrine disrupting? Like, do they have xenoestrogens in them? Are they messing with your period? We have so many people with menstrual migraine issues or menstrual dizziness issues. What else? Pesticides, plastics. Are you living in a moldy environment? Have you been exposed to heavy metals? Like all of these things that are considered outside the box right now, which I'm hoping as time goes on, they're not so outside the box, because I really think it should be standard of care. But those are kind of the big picture things that I'm thinking when people come to me.